welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmandel, and I'm your host on today's program, The State of Independent Publishing. Recently, one of the largest distributors of independent periodicals went out of business, leaving lots of publications in the lurch and owed a lot of money. And things aren't necessarily even looking good at the very small scale of independent zines. So we'll be hearing from Anita Michael, herself a zine publisher and someone who has been watching the independent publishing scene for many, many years. She's the Media Geek Zine Queen. So you do want to stay tuned. Now, before we get into the show's feature, we're going to check up with what's been going on in our media environment with some Media Geek headline news. House Democrats got their first shot at grilling all five commissioners of the FCC on March 14th. The Telecommunications and Internet Subcommittee, chaired by outspoken Representative Edward Markey of Massachusetts, reserved its strongest rebukes for FCC Chairman Kevin Martin. In particular, representatives criticized the commission for lacking transparency and acting in a heavy-handed manner. Representative Anna Eshoo of California jibed Martin for, quote, being the father of a new word in the English language, unrecused, end quote. That was a reference to Martin's efforts to keep fellow Commissioner Robert McDowell from recusing himself from the decision on approving last year's AT&T Bell South merger. Prior to joining the commission, McDowell had worked for the industry association representing the small telephone companies that compete with AT&T and Bell South. McDowell felt he had a conflict of interest, and he did remain recused. Markey and House Energy and Commerce Committee Chairman John Dingell both complained about the FCC's decision to ease franchise restrictions on new video service providers like AT&T and Verizon. They said the decision reduced the authority of local governments. Markey also raised concerns about the slow pace of broadband internet penetration in the U.S., saying that, quote, Americans currently suffer from a lack of a broadband plan, end quote. The previous week, Democratic FCC Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein also issued a stinging critique over the Bush administration's failed policy on broadband internet deployment. He told the Freedom to Connect Technology Conference that wider access to high-speed internet, quote, has got to be a greater national priority than it is now, end quote. At the Telecommunications and Internet Subcommittee hearing, Democrats also pushed the FCC on network neutrality, but Martin reiterated his opposition to it, while the FCC's two Democrats restated their support. Markey promised to hold hearings on network neutrality, and many of its fellow Democrats promised to have the commissioners back more frequently in order to effect more direct oversight over the FCC. Continuing the focus on the FCC, Chairman Martin has released a loaded agenda for the commission's March 22nd meeting with 13 policy items scheduled for a vote. Among those items are the approval of a $2.7 billion sale of 22 ABC radio stations to Citadel Broadcasting and the categorization of wireless internet services as an information service, which would allow the providers to avoid public interest obligations associated with common carrier service, such as the requirement that companies open their networks to competitors. Also on the agenda is a rulemaking on digital radio, also known as IBOC or HD radio. The commission may decide the rules that will apply to digital radio, including the ability of stations to have multiple program channels and services under one digital frequency, and also some possible public service obligations that broadcasters would have in exchange for these free additional channels. By packing so many decisions into this meeting, Chairman Martin is viewed as trying to force the hand of Democratic commissioners who would prefer to see more public interest considerations in many of these issues. Nevertheless, items can be removed if commissioners object or approval can be won through so-called circulation, where each commissioner approves on a particular item before the meeting. And of course, I'll bring you more news about what happens at that meeting on the next edition of Media Geek here. And that is where you're tuned to Media Geek. Well, as I mentioned at the intro of the show, the Independent Press Association had a distributorship which went out of business at the end of last year, leaving a lot of independent publications in the lurch, owed a lot of money, and actually forcing some right out of business. Combined with that, there seems to be a lot of changes going on in zines. Zines are independent publications put out usually by individuals or small groups of individuals, usually in small quantities, a few hundred, often traded through the mails or sold in independent record stores or independent bookstores. There's a lot of changes going on, possibly in, you know, with respect to the internet, putting a little bit of force on it, and because of what goes on with independent magazines. So to look more into, talk more about it, and get some more perspective, I turn to Media Geek's zine queen, Anita Michael. She herself produces a zine called Syndicate Product. She previously published a zine called Low Hug. She used to live here in Champaign-Urbana, the home of the Media Geek radio program, and she'd be on periodically to tell us about what's going on in the zine world and share some of her favorite independent publications. Now she calls Philadelphia her home base, but was kind enough to set up an internet phone call with me to talk a little bit more about what the heck is going on in the world of independent publishing.
Anita, thanks for joining me again. It's been about a year since you were last on to talk about zines.
Yeah.
Recently, you know, we've had some email where you were mentioning to me that you're starting to feel a little less confident in the state of zining and zines right now.
Well, actually, it's not just zines. I would say I'm feeling less confident in small publishing in general. And by small publishing, I mean, I call it like magazines that embody the zine spirit, such as titles like Punk Planet and Bitch, Bust, things like that. Because there's been trouble with some of the large distributors lately. Two of them went completely bankrupt, including one called that was associated with the Independent Press Association. And just so the listeners understand, when magazines reach a certain circulation, they distribute their things to newsstands through distributors. They don't pack up the magazines themselves and send them, you know, to every Borders or you know, bookstore like. And one of the largest distributors of these small press magazines, the IPA, went belly up earlier this year, and I'm just starting to find out exactly how bad it was. Bitch Magazine, for example, is owed $81,000, which is a huge amount for a small magazine.
Yeah.
And also, I'm not sure if you've mentioned this on the show, Clamour Magazine went under, in large part to the money owed to them by their distributors. Let's see, Herbivore Magazine is hurting as well. They're just only going to do 2 print issues this year and do a lot online. Venus Magazine was really affected as well. Kitchen Sink went under, the magazine, not the comic book distributor. Lip went under, and Clamour went under. So, you know, it's not for the better. And also, Tower Records, as you know, the entire chain closed. And Tower had a really fantastic zine buyer, and they really supported very small press. I mean, I'm talking smaller than small magazines. I'm talking people who would, you know, print 200 copies of their zine. So, I mean, that's another outlet that's gone.
Mm-hmm. I remember when I lived near a Tower, which has been quite some time now, but when I lived on the East Coast, that's where I would go to find a lot of independent or very almost underground zines and magazines, mm-hmm. both in the records locations and in, they used to have bookstores as well, like
right,
in Philadelphia.
Did, yeah. So there's very few ways to get your small publication out. I mean, if you're bigger than just, you know, doing 200 copies as like a traditional zine.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting to me is I actually attended a session at the last Allied Media Conference, which is the last one that they will have held in Bowling Green, Ohio, mm-hmm. and heard representatives from Bitch Magazine and from Clamour talk, you know, quite honestly about the debts that they had owed to them by the IPA and how keeping their publications running was getting increasingly difficult. Not to mention the fact that it's already difficult to get distribution to begin with and to get into bookstores and periodical racks in the first place. And I think something which also sets apart a lot of these independent magazines that were being distributed by the IPA is that they did not tend to rely on advertising as much as big national magazines like a Time magazine or People or something.
What advertising they did have was a lot cheaper than a national magazine, and they were very selective in the advertising they took. I know, to go back to the example of Bitch, they actually did a reader poll because they were offered the chance to run cigarette ads. And their readers said, no, don't do it. We would pay higher subscription rates not to have cigarette ads.
I remember seeing that because my partner gets Bitch magazine. I remember seeing the poll. I remember reading. They sent out subscription reminders to their subscribers saying, you know, we asked you what you thought about this, and overwhelmingly you said you don't want us to carry tobacco advertising, so help us out then, because that means we had to turn down a whole lot of advertising money in order to stick to our, you know, politics and our ideals here, but we need you to be a partner in that.
Right. And subscriptions are the best way to support small press magazines, but the thing is, how do you find the magazines you want to subscribe to if they're not on the newsstand for you to discover?
Mm-hmm.
So there's problems in the small magazine realm, and I guess I'm a little bit concerned about the actual zine publishing world as well.
And to set these two apart, so that people maybe who haven't heard us talk about zines before, zines are much more independent, shall we say, almost generally very personal in nature, small publications put out by people that stand in part from these sort of independent magazines, which are generally more collective enterprises and tend to attempt to have larger distribution and many more copies out there.
Exactly. I mean, zines, I would say, you know, it's still a zine if you have, you know, a print run of 500 or less, and you're still mailing it out yourself and et cetera. Now, obviously, I'm not saying that, you know, zines are somehow superior to small press magazines, because as I mentioned before, I think small press magazines embody a lot of the original spirit of zine publishing, but, you know, they're just able to get out to more people, and I think that's a good thing. But as far, I mean, I know a lot of, you know, small zine publishers that are just giving it up as well. They're just tired, or they're just moving everything onto the web. And a bunch of years ago, I probably was on your show, probably live in the studio, and I probably said something around, you know, oh no, the web will never replace zines. It is possible to do a blog for completely free nowadays. There's public access computing sites, which, you know, it's not the same as having a computer, but every library in this country has at least one public access computer, thanks to the Gates Foundation. And there's so many places to host blogs for free, like Blogspot is free. I think WordPress has some free hosting, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But it almost seems easier to do a blog right now instead of a zine. I mean, you can literally do it for free.
Well, so how is, I mean, let's tease this apart a little bit. I mean, let's go back a few years. Why would you or anyone choose to make a zine, you know, let's say just even looking back 3 or 4 years ago, just as blogging became more well known and became more popular, what is it about doing a zine? What is the difference of it that is a reason why someone would choose to do that as opposed to a blog, or, you know, not necessarily opposed to, but in addition to even?
I think it probably largely comes down to design, and, you know, you enjoy doing layout, you enjoy, you know, playing with fonts and cutting and pasting and et cetera. And I think also you don't mind a delay in your words getting out, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
What you're writing is not so immediate that it has to be published in the next 12 hours.
Blogs, I think a lot of what has been said is great about them is how quick it is and how they're very much of the moment. And zines don't necessarily have to be quite that way. And I do think that there's this physicality to it, and part of the physicality lends to its durability. And then I go through my collection at times and will read a zine from 5, 6, 7 years ago and reread it. And I wonder more about how that happens in the blogosphere, or if it happens.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure people go back and read their favorite blog posts. I know exactly what you're talking about going back and sorting through zines and like, oh, I remember this one. This was a fantastic issue.
I think the only time that I end up reading old blog posts are through Google searches. You know, you go and look for some particular topic or item, and it turns out that someone on their blog wrote about it several years ago, yeah. And maybe they were one of the only people ever write about that topic. Mm-hmm. And I see, looking at my own traffic statistics for my own website, I see that there are certain posts that continue to get a lot of hits even years after they were written. And if I, you know, as much as I can analyze that traffic, it looks like so much of that traffic gets referred by Google.
I don't want to say that the zine world is going away. I was thinking about this a lot, and it's changing. One thing I'm noticing is there's a lot of craft zines now, because crafting and knitting is very big right now.
And so is scrapbooking.
Yeah.
And I'm not really saying that they're the same thing, but maybe the physicality and the paste up and the markup element of zines is a more, for lack of a better word, punk version of scrapbooking.
I would say that. And I also have a lot of, this is going to sound bizarre, but I have a lot of issues with the scrapbooking industry.
Sure.
Basically because they kind of sell everything pre-cut, pre-done. Here's a kit. All you have to do is plug in your family photos and your page is done. There doesn't seem to be any real base creativity in it.
Yes, it's a bit more like color forms. It's like as if you couldn't write your own funny captions, you have to get a sticker that has the caption
on it. Exactly, exactly. And, you know, I don't go to craft stores a lot, but I am fascinated by the scrapbook aisles. And I've picked up, like, blocks of the backgrounds and stuff just to use as backgrounds in zines. I don't scrapbook, but also to back to the whole crafty, there are a lot of craft zines, small craft zines popping up. I mean, obviously there's the big one called Craft, which is a magazine by the same people who did Make, which is this big,
it's O'Reilly, which is a big tech publisher,
yeah.
Known previously more for their manuals on how to write PHP code or program or do HTML. And then they started branching out into these not quite general interests, but broader interest magazines.
Yeah, I do think they both Make and Craft do embody the spirit of zining,
mm-hmm.
but within the magazine format. But yeah, they're... I don't myself read a lot of craft zines because I'm pretty much useless when it comes to a lot of that, except for paper crafts. I don't knit or I don't sew or anything like that. But there's one called Croc, short for croquet, C-R-O-Q. That's a lot of fun. And look through like Xerography, Debt, and Zine World. I am seeing more craft zines. And the other thing I'm seeing a lot of are parenting and mommy and daddy zines, and which is something else that is kind of foreign to me. But I can understand how that's growing as well, because, you know, as alternative types who used to do regular zines grow up and become parents, you know, they're not going to read, you know, what's on the newsstand for parenting advice.
Right. Some of the classic ones like Zuzu and the Baby Catcher or the East Village Inky
yes.
have been around for a lot of years,
mm-hmm.
but I guess more and more zinesters are aging. So are you, as you look through Zine World or you look through Xerography Debt, which are two review zines that sort of mm-hmm. talk, you know, list lots of other zines and review them and serve as a directory of sorts, are you seeing fewer zines by younger people in their, say, late teens and early 20s?
Well, I can't really tell about ages, but I will say that I'm seeing less what would be called general interest or quirky popular culture zines. Like in the mid 80s, early 90s, yeah, you had zines about the Brady Bunch. You had zines about Beverly Hills 90210. You had a lot more film zines about cult films, cult and underground filmmaking. Now, basically, when I look through Zine World and Xerography Debt, I see a lot of per-zines, personal zines, which are kind of diary formats. I see a lot of parenting zines, and I'm starting to see more craft zines. I'm not seeing as many things about cultural items.
So the punk artists, are punk zines then starting to evaporate?
I think punk zines come and go more quick other types of zines. And plus some of the larger punk zines like Punk Planet and such and Maximum Rock and Roll were also affected by the IPA.
Are they still publishing? It's been so long since I've really looked for them, I have to be honest.
Yeah, they are. I know Punk Planet is owed about $16,000, which is huge mm-hmm. for them. But as far as I know, they're still going to publish print issues.
And they're based out of Chicago, I believe.
Yeah. Actually, I don't see as many music zines anymore. Now, the more I think about it, there's really not a lot of specific music zines. This is just what I'm seeing in these review zines. Mm-hmm. You know, it's always been a challenge to find zines that you like. And if they're not reviewed in the review zines or reviewed in somebody else's zine, you're going to miss them.
Right, because typically the way you can find a zine is by directly requesting it from the publisher or by, if you're lucky enough to have a bookstore that sells zines, you might happen upon them there.
Yeah, and there are a few very small distributors like Microcosm Publishing that, you know, do distribution, but they're targeted. They basically do a lot of per zines and political zines and such.
Mm-hmm. Looking at these review zines, are you seeing fewer zines generally? Are they getting thinner?
No, they're not getting thinner, but in the case of something like Xerography Debt, Xerography Debt's a little different in the fact that the reviewers just kind of write about stuff they like because they figure, why should people waste time on crap? I'll find, you know, the same zine reviewed four or five times by different reviewers.
So definitely it's a bit like the blogosphere. When they find something they like, they're all sort of around it, huh?
Yeah, exactly. And this is just highly a personal thing. I'm just finding a lot less that I want to order up. And, you know, that could be a personal choice because obviously I'm not going to read a lot of parenting zines, although I have, because there are some, you know, really good ones out there that appeal to you even if you don't have kids.
Definitely, I've seen over the years, there's this ebb and flow in the zine community, and although maybe the trends come more slowly than in a lot of online culture, there definitely is trends that come and go as well.
But I mean, one thing that really struck me as I was looking at the website for the Allied Media Conference 2007, which is going to be held in Detroit this year, there is no zine anywhere on the site.
Yeah, and for a lot of people who probably don't realize, the Allied Media Conference got its start as the Underground Publishing Conference.
Exactly.
And was incredibly heavy with zinesters and with an exhibition hall full of people selling their individual zines. You know, that was probably, you know, 4 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago. And as recently as last year, the exhibition hall, very few individual zinesters to be found, a few distros to be found. But most of the people who were renting tables were more about larger organizations or working in music, video, T-shirts and that sort of thing.
There's these very small grassroots, you know, zine fest, like little one-day zine fest that pop up here and there. But they're very difficult to find out about if you're not in the know or if you don't constantly monitor some of the, like the, there's a Yahoo group, there's several zine Yahoo groups, you know, monitoring them constantly. There was just a small zine thing down in Baltimore last weekend that unfortunately I found out about too late, You know, so people are, you know, trying to keep the zine thing going. And, you know, maybe this is just a, maybe this just is a slow, maybe this is the a slow period.
I wonder also if maybe it isn't becoming a bit regionalized. You know, I mean, for instance, Microcosm Publishing is out of Portland, Oregon, which has developed a very vibrant DIY culture, generally speaking. And then part of that has been zine culture, where, you know, and they're supporting bookstores, and then they have the Independent Publishing Resource Center, and then also their big zine events in places like San Francisco, you know, some larger cities. I wonder if it isn't becoming a more regionalized phenomenon in a lot of ways.
Well, it's true that you can't go to Portland without, you know, running into somebody who does a zine every couple of feet. I remember a couple of years ago, somebody went through an old issue of Zine Guide, or it was Zine Guide, which is no longer published, and did kind of a geographic survey of, you know, where were zines being published out of. And a lot were coming out of Portland.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and they do have the amazing resource of the Independent Publishing Center.
Part of the received history of zines, and certainly the history that I think of with zines, is that a lot of it was a way for, you know, disenfranchised youth to be able to connect up with other like-minded kids around the country. So often it could be a kid in Lincoln, Nebraska, or a kid, you know, in Manhattan, Kansas, or even in smaller towns, would find out that there were other kids making zines and had a network which they could trade with. And I wonder if increasingly they aren't just simply turning to MySpace.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure they're completely turning to MySpace. I mean, I first found out about zines when I was about 15 years old, and I went to my local comic book store, and on the free pile there were these, you know, weird little staple things, and I picked a couple up, and from that I, you know, I ordered some other ones from the back, and et cetera, et cetera. But when you think about it, gee, that takes too much effort now. I'll just, you know, go set up a thing on MySpace, and, well, not too surprising, I have some issues with MySpace as well.
Well, me too. No way am I going to lend my content to Rupert Murdoch.
Exactly.
And there I was speaking to Anita Michael. AJ Michael, as she's known in her zine Syndicate product. You can check out her blog at syndicateproduct.blogspot.com, where you can learn how you can get an issue of her zine and also read her various thoughts on independent publishing and other matters of popular and unpopular culture.
That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm host and producer Paul Riesmandel. I'll be back in 1 week with another half-hour look at independent and grassroots media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. In the meantime, check out the frequently updated Media Geek blog at MediaGeek.net. The program can also be downloaded at Radio.MediaGeek.net, where you can subscribe to the podcast. Media Geek is produced at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, and is heard on 10 other community stations around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, WYQZ in Warrenton, Bealeton, Virginia, KWMD Kasilov in Anchorage, Alaska, and Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington. It's also on the web at Free Radio San Diego, Pirate969.org, and RadioDriftless.org. Media Geek is free to air on your local non-commercial station too. Just email Paul at MediaGeek.net. That's also where you can send comments about the program, Paul at MediaGeek.net. Thanks for tuning in.